Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
We need a public option in retirement.
We continue our conversation with Connecticut scholar James W. Russell of Eastern Connecticut State University. A well-known author, Russell has been much in demand as a speaker on the state and national retirement fund crisis. It's like a perfect storm. With rising costs of living, slow wages, a down market, ever higher health care costs, America's teachers and other state employees have lost as much as 40% of their life savings, just ahead of their retirement years. They bought into an alternate retirement program run by ING International and had high hopes of earning far more. But at this point, even if they were to contribute twice as much to their funds as those who stayed in the conventional retirement system, they would still receive less than half as much in benefits. In his recent book, Double Standard, Social Policy in Europe and the United States, James W. Russell looked at how changes to government policies could correct major social problems. Here we talk about the retirement fund crisis in context with a failing health care reform effort in Washington. Wall Street is also doing better, but we asked James Russell if that means the crisis is resolving for average Americans.
It's certainly true that the stock market has recovered a little bit. It certainly hasn't gone back to where it was before. So for a certain group of people, the crisis is attenuating. But then again, we're also seeing that the unemployment rate is climbing. And so on, you know, different ends of the spectrum, it's either getting worse or it's getting better. I think that's true in all of these kinds of crises, and certainly even in normal times, because the economy is so complicated that depending upon where you are within it, you can be doing better when other people are doing worse and vice versa, which is not to say that I think it all evens out. It's to say that it's a very variegated picture of what's happening. And if we're in a recovery, you know, whether it's a long-term one or just a temporary one, there are certainly people who are not a part of that recovery, or at least not yet a part of that recovery.
Well, retirement funds have to be created under a kind of social contract. It's just that it's a one-way street here. I mean, if people can't get out of this fund, even when it tanks, you know, loses 40%, then they have basically zero protection for the money they need to pay health care bills and other costs of retirement. You know, society's at risk because then, you know, the government may have to step in and take care of people. Now, of course, as costs continue to rise, there are questions of just what people are supposed to do in order to obtain enough capital to retire on. Here they seem to be giving profits to managers. How, by the way, do these managers justify this huge income off of people who are trying to save to retire?
I'm not so sure that they're greatly worried about justifying it to themselves. They're setting up a business, and they're going to set up the business like anything else in an unregulated climate where nobody is really looking out for the people who might be victims of this. And also, I think what adds to this, because finance is so complicated, as we've certainly learned in this crisis, I mean, that you can set up all kinds of exotic products that the people who are supposed to be regulating them, if they're even allowed to regulate them, don't even understand what they are. I would argue in Connecticut, it may be an exaggeration, that there's probably not 20 people who really understand how the state pension fund operates. But many more people make decisions about it, you know, whether they're in legislatures or whether they're in advocacy groups, you know, whether they're unions charged with protecting the interests of their members. Okay, but if you set these things up in such a way that they're incredibly complicated, that then becomes a way of shielding them, really, from any deep public scrutiny. You know, we're just dealing with a slice of what is a much bigger problem. I don't want to indicate that we're sort of unusual victims. Lots of people are facing this issue in all different manifestations of it. What, you know, if they have 401ks, if they no longer have traditional pension funds, if they have nothing, all of that. I mean, the general issue is if people work, you know, 30, 40 years of their life, they really deserve to have support in retirement. And it's tremendously uneven, you know, all over the United States, from people who in our case, we're talking about one company, ING, which is a Dutch financial services company that was given the business in Connecticut to manage the alternate retirement program for state employees. They collect their management fees and I presume commissions also on whatever they sell within it. And whether they're better or they're worse than other ones that do that, I don't know. I mean, I'm not so much interested in them being a particularly bad one as in this whole approach is a particularly bad approach to ensuring retirement security.
You say there's a simple, direct solution here, and that is to allow people in this alternative retirement plan to roll over what they've accumulated and purchase service credits in the state's retirement service.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how that would work.
It's allowed in a number of states that if you're in one retirement system, you can move into another one. And that's what we're advocating in Connecticut because we're in what we call a failed retirement system. And so we're trying to win in the state legislature, perhaps directly from our employers, a change so that we would be able to take what we have built up in this privatized system and roll it over into the public pension, which is a much more sound basis for financing retirement. It works in other states, you know, so it's not a question of whether it can work or not work. It can clearly work. It's a political question, you know, whether people who have the power to do this are willing to allow this to occur. That's the solution to our problem. For a lot of people, they don't have that solution, like they're in a 401k, so there's no obvious public pension plan that they could roll over into. But I think that there are creative solutions for them, too. And this is one that nobody is talking about on a national level, but I think it would work. There's something called a nonprofit annuity. Right now, if you're in a 401k, what you're supposed to do when you retire is you either take your money in a lump sum, which is not a very smart thing to do because then you have to pay a lot of taxes on a windfall, or you annuitize it, which means you give the money to an insurance company, which then guarantees to pay you a percentage of that money for the rest of your life. The insurance companies sell a for-profit annuity. Right now, it's about 5%. So if you have $100,000 built up, you would get $5,000 a year for the rest of your life. What a nonprofit annuity would be is if some public agency said, okay, give us that money. Okay, we don't need a profit. We're just going to do this on a revenue-neutral basis. You know, so we don't want to lose money on it, but we don't want to make money on it. We're just going to do this. They could pay a much higher percentage, you know, maybe as much as 8% rather than 5%. And this is the bottom line here. So what public agency could do that? Deal with the whole mess that has been created by the 401k transformation. Social Security. Okay. I would argue that, you know, if we got some senators and congressmen behind this, that Social Security could start selling nonprofit annuities to people, and that would at least help the situation that they were in. It still wouldn't be as good as having a traditional pension, but it would be a lot better than being doubly victims of the financial services industry. When I say doubly victims, you're victims while you're paying money into the 401k, and then when it comes time to retire, this becomes still another opportunity for them to make a profit off of whatever you've managed to build up during your lifetime. And so if we could remove that profit, at least from the end of this thing, so that people could get a higher interest rate annuity, that would work. Of course, insurance companies wouldn't like that competition from the federal government. It's sort of like healthcare reform. You know, they don't want a public option. And that's what we're saying is we need a public option in retirement.
And if someone did buy an annuity, a nonprofit one, at 8%, what would they get, you know, per year, let's say?
Use the math, you know, like if you have $100,000 and, you know, you would get $5,000 a year under a for-profit annuity, you might get $8,000. That's a lot more, right? And, you know, that's 30-40% more simply by taking the profit out of this. You have to take my numbers with it with a grain of salt here. Actuarials have to get involved in it and so forth. But there's no question that if you remove the profit from the annuity business, retired people can do significantly better.
You know, are there wild profits being made?
Absolutely. Since 1980, the amount of people employed by the financial services industry has doubled as a percentage of the overall labor force. So there's been an enormous expansion. And what has fueled that expansion, for the most part, has been the transformation of retirement savings from traditional pensions into these types of privatized accounts. There's absolutely no question that this has been a huge development in the country. What we've essentially gotten, to get a little more theoretical about it, is the creation of finance capitalism. You know, moving from things flowing mainly through industries, banks performing humble jobs of just facilitating the circulation of funding in the system, to now the way in which banks, insurance companies are now taking all of this financing itself and then creating ways to make more profit off of it. But to do that, you're constantly seeking new sources. And the greatest new source of financing for them was to capture workers' retirement savings. Okay, and thank goodness that Bush was not successful in privatizing Social Security. That was the biggest prize of all, was to get a hold of that. He wasn't able to do it, and fortunately, you know, enough people realized it, put enough pressure on Congress that slowed it down and then stopped it. Okay. Even among conservatives. Conservatives have family members that depend on Social Security, too. They've been much more successful elsewhere in terms of transforming traditional pensions to 401ks, you know, among state workers to set up these types of alternate systems and then to dupe people into them. And then once they were in them, tell them that they couldn't get out of them. And so it's a mess at a national level, and it's a mess for individuals who approach retirement.
How many of Connecticut's workers bought into this alternate retirement fund?
The state of Connecticut has about 50,000 active workers. And of those, about 8,500 are in this alternate retirement program. There are also retired workers, and, you know, that's another set of numbers, but this is among active workers. 17-18% of state employees in Connecticut are affected by this particular issue. I would argue that all of them are, to the extent that if the reform that we're advocating is successful, we would actually improve the state pension fund because we would be bringing a fresh infusion of money into it. We would decrease the unfunded liability within it. It's really to the advantage of the state of Connecticut to allow this. It's not to the advantage of ING, however.
Are there any legislators that are working on behalf of investors and trying to solve this crisis?
If you go to our website, you can Google Connecticut ARP, A-R-P, crisis, and you'll get to the website. We have links to a frontline video called Can You Afford to Retire? And it describes Nebraska, that in Nebraska there was a benefits adequacy study because they had a plan like the one in Connecticut, and the legislature concluded that it didn't work. And so it moved away from that approach to much more of a traditional pension approach. So here and there, there are legislatures doing things because pension funds, all of that is huge in terms of the amount of money that's involved in it. And every once in a while, different legislatures try to tackle it in various kinds of ways.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio, and we're speaking with James W. Russell, a writer and lecturer who teaches in the sociology department at Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic, Connecticut. When we compared news reports about financial, health insurance, and retirement fund companies, we were struck by the similarities in details about the biggest problems for consumers. In the financial industry, we saw both investment companies and credit card companies raise their profits through hidden fees. According to Russell, this is also a possibility with retirement fund management companies.
The vast majority of people have no idea what's going on, and a lot of that is hidden. There is a claim that they changed the system from TIAA CREF to ING because ING had lower fees. I have not been able to verify that claim. I haven't really tried to verify that claim. But the whole issue of the fees is a big issue. There's a bill in Congress sponsored by George Miller of California to make the fees that are being charged in the whole 401k business more transparent. And apparently that bill is going nowhere. The financial services industry is heavily lobbying against it. But in some ways, I think it's a very deceptive issue because it's making it look like, well, if we could get the fees under control, then this system would work. See, I would argue even if you had the most honest fees in the world, it doesn't work as a system, as an approach to financing retirement. It's very parallel to the whole healthcare issue. We know that the public sector does a better job of delivering healthcare. And that's why every other high-income country in the world, European, Japanese, so forth, all of them have the majority of their healthcare system is organized through the public sector. Not all of it, okay, but the majority of it is there. In the United States, it's the minority that's organized through the public sector, and therefore we have the most expensive system in the world. It's the same way with retirement. If you have it, you know, a dedicated system through the public sector, it's much lower cost and a much higher value that comes from it. The whole issue of the fees, while it's important and it explains, you know, a lot of the corruption and, you know, all of that that's going on, it shouldn't be the total focus of reform.
As with other industries, when retirement funds went down for investors at ING, top executives continued to take big salaries and bonuses anyway.
In the case of the company that runs the alternate retirement program in Connecticut, they were forced into a bailout situation with the Dutch government. You know, Dutch government had to bail out ING. In the same year, they handed out $410 million in executive bonuses. So the whole industry is rife with that type of abuse with the people at the top. And of course, it's no accident that during this period of time, we also get deregulation. We also get lowering of progressive income tax in the United States and, of course, accelerating inequality of income with a very tiny group at the top just making fabulous amounts of money. All kinds of different ways that they do that, but certainly the getting hold of workers' collective retirement money. You know, as a lot of people say, I mean, these are people who make their money by controlling other people's money, and that's essentially what they're doing. Money that should be yours and mine, which it is, but they're in control of it, so they're making money off of it. Certainly no one is told that in the list of priorities, the executive salary comes far ahead of the priority to make sure that they have a decent retirement. I mean, it's really just traditional capitalism where you skim money off of many, many people. You know, maybe from me, they're taking $50 a year, you know, to support the bonuses. And, well, $50, that's not so much money. But, you know, if they're doing that for 20 million people, then, of course, it's quite a hefty sum of money that supports them. And one of the things that happens in these systems, which is really kind of Kafkaesque, is that I think there's some sort of regulation in SEC or someplace that says that they have to inform the participants in these programs of how the stocks are doing. So we get in the mail these huge documents. See, that I work in a university, and I've yet to find anybody in the university who actually understands the document. There are numbers all over the place. And, you know, maybe there is somebody in finances or business who really into following this and they can understand what these things mean. But there's no question that the vast majority of people have no idea what this means. And I include myself in this, and I'm, you know, an activist on the issue. So they churn out what is supposed to be information, but it's in such a form that you can't understand. And I'm sure if you went through all of that form and you understood it, you still couldn't figure out how much, you know, of what you're paying into these plans is going to support CEO bonuses. You know, all of that is, I'm sure, heavily disguised in the reporting.
According to ING's website, the company has done some firing and rehiring of top managers, but their policy of handing out large salaries and bonuses is pretty much intact. The company will be holding back bonuses for underperformers, but plan to reward others with, quote, generous bonuses paid to top performers, who will also receive a consistency premium. Two ING broker-dealers based in Windsor, Connecticut, are staying on. The company noted that they're, quote, aligned with ING's product strategy in the United States, and investors may have some newly published materials to review and try to understand. In November, ING sold most of its U.S. broker-dealer network to Lightyear Capital of New York. We didn't have to go far to track down a similar story of window dressing rather than real change within the health insurance industry. Aetna CEO Ronald A. Williams continues to receive a gargantuan income even as consumers struggle to pay their bills. In October of 2009, the David T. Chase Free Enterprise Institute at Eastern Connecticut State University, where James W. Russell teaches, announced that Ronald Williams would be an executive professor there. They cited him for his important community service work and have described him as a recognized authority on issues relating to national health care reform. In fact, Williams is also a recognized leader when it comes to the health insurance industry's claims that it can address its own problems, that federal health care reforms are unnecessary. The conflict of interest is obvious when you note just how much top CEOs are making these days. Award-winning journalist Morton Mintz, a senior advisor at the Nieman Foundation's Watchdog Project, criticized Williams for raking in a total of more than $47,346,000 in personal income from the industry over the past 2 years.
I think that it is, first of all, beyond belief that anybody could possibly need or sensibly use so much money and income like that. I mean, to me, it's, you know, on a personal level, it's preposterous. Like, who needs it? But it's really unattractive, shall we say, that someone who's selling health insurance should be paid that kind of money when we have, for example, by the estimate of people at the Harvard School of Public Health, 45,000 Americans who die of treatable diseases that are not treated every year. 45,000 people, and this guy is getting this kind of money. It's just ridiculous.
The combined force of influence from Connecticut healthcare giant Aetna and other companies like it has helped undercut the progress of a healthcare bill in Washington that began as a response to an American crisis. And the proposals Williams has been offering would amount to very little in the way of savings and reforms. He has overhauled Aetna's website so that consumers can see how much they'd save by purchasing drugs like Lipitor from Aetna rather than from their own pharmacies. And he's improved the digital world Aetna operates in so that both patient information and financial data about the company's investments can flow more easily. Aetna has also announced that 1,200 Connecticut workers will be losing their jobs, though CEO Williams assured investors that none of the fired workers would be in the financial division. Through lobbying and other efforts, the health insurance industry was ultimately able to pull a shocking amount of profit out of the Senate's reform bill. And on September 16th, top Democrat Howard Dean told Vermont Public Radio the Senate should drop the bill and send it back to the House for revision.
There are some good things in this bill, but they're small. And let's have a small bill for this. $32 billion doesn't sound like a small amount, but compared to $1 trillion, 27% of which is going to go into the insurance company's pockets, it's a small price to pay to help community health care centers and prevention and wellness programs.
Howard Dean's remarks came after Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman voted to kill a proposal that the health care bill be used to allow uninsured Americans over age 55 to buy into Medicare. We asked James W. Russell if more profitability for the insurance industry or for retirement fund managers might one day translate into better living conditions for the majority who don't earn six-figure incomes, the so-called trickle-down effect.
Certainly, the managers of ING and others that depend upon these privatized accounts want to maintain that. I really don't think that this, though, is to the benefit of the larger state of Connecticut, and certainly not to the retirees who, or potential retirees that are continually bleeded in this process. I mean, you know, perhaps you can make a strictly economic argument that sort of moving money through the private channel helps the private economy, but that's not the total economy, and it's certainly not the whole social side of this as well. I mean, we have to really keep focused on the central issue is we want a retirement plan to actually work. And by work, it means that it produces enough income security for people when they're retired. We don't want people to be paying into these things for 30 years, get ready to retire, and discover, oops, you know, there's no money here, okay, or there's very little money here, and so I have to keep working. So this was all a myth that, you know, I was going to have a retirement. We don't want that to happen, and that's what's happening today.
Well, under the circumstances of the current crisis, should the government step in and try to reclaim some of the bonus money given to top executives in financial, health insurance, or retirement fund companies?
I think that there's definitely need for a national plan to resolve this crisis. I'm not holding my breath on it. We've seen how difficult getting any kind of health reform is to begin to confront the retirement crisis in the United States at a national level is something that is going to have to happen. How soon it will happen is anybody's guess. But it's similar to in Chile when it became clear that this whole transformation of the Chilean retirement system, which actually George W. Bush cited favorably when he was trying to privatize Social Security, when it was clear that it had created a crisis, there is indeed now in Chile an attempt to come to some solution to it. I don't know where that's going to go. And the same thing happened in the United Kingdom when Margaret Thatcher pushed through privatization. By the early 90s, they realized it wasn't working, and then they allowed people to go back into the National Pension Fund. We need to do something like that in the United States. And if I was given a wish list, what would come out of it would be not just a defense of Social Security as it is, but an expansion of Social Security. The virtue of Social Security, the many virtues of it, include the fact that it's portable. I mean, wherever you work for, you could theoretically pay into Social Security. So if we had a kind of pyramid type of thing where Social Security made up the biggest chunk of a person's retirement income, bigger than it does now, pay more taxes into it, and begin to phase out the occupational pension and 401k. And then you can have some kind of system for people saving to augment their retirement. But the personal savings should be the smallest part of it. I'm arguing directly the opposite of the neoliberals who say that all retirement should be based on personal savings. It just doesn't work. We need social insurance, a national social insurance, and we already have the model in Social Security, so just expand it, and then you can have maybe do some tax things to encourage people to save some money. Okay, but that should be just kind of like topping off the pyramid.
James W. Russell is in the sociology department at Eastern Connecticut State University. His latest book was Double Standard, Social Policy in Europe and the United States. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is syndicated with Pacifica Network, talknationradio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.